We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
In the late 1870s, the American economy was booming, but all Americans did not share equally in the benefits. A new class of super rich was engaged in what came to be called conspicuous consumption as the spread between the haves and the have-nots reached unprecedented levels. Mark Twain, in a novel that he wrote at the time, called it the Gilded Age. And there are some people who argue, and have been arguing now for some years, that we are living through a second Gilded Age. So the question we try to take up this morning is, are there indeed strong parallels between that time and ours? And is there even a point to asking a question like that and drawing comparisons between one historic period and another? Well, our guest for the program for this hour, one of the country's leading historians, David Kennedy. He is the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University. Has written a number of works of history. He's been involved with recent editions of a popular history textbook, The American Pageant. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his book World War I Over Here, The First World War in American Society. And he won the Pulitzer Prize for history for his book Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War. He is joining us this morning by phone as we talk. Questions are certainly welcome, and we invite people to send us emails or call in. We just hope people will be brief so that we can make the show move along and get in as many different callers as possible. But questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you can also send along your emails to will-talk. That's just like it sounds, willo-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Kennedy, hello.
Good morning, David. Happy to be with you today.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I'm not sure at what point this caught our attention, but when you look at this, it seems quite clear that for now going back a number of years, journalists, political commentators, academics have been doing this, have been drawing comparisons between our time, particularly when things were still booming here before the last couple of years, and that period in the late 19th century that, because of Twain, we call the Gilded Age. Just as an aside, I do think it's interesting that the book, which probably a lot of people haven't really read, it not only is a commentary on the sins of the newly rich, but it has as a major theme people trying to make fortunes by speculating in real estate. So that definitely has some resonance. Just to start off, before we really talk about the Gilded Age and where we are now, do you think that's appropriate to draw those sorts of comparisons between the last few years and the late 19th century?
Well, I think the comparison suggests itself for a lot of reasons, some of which you mentioned in your lead there at the top of the hour, especially enormous income disparities and widening gaps in ways of life between the successful and the less successful. That had all kinds of dimensions in the 19th century as the super rich emerged. People moved into cities in huge numbers and by and large lived pretty miserable lives in cities, both immigrants and internal migrants alike. So those disparities in ways of life and income levels and so on is one obvious comparison between that age and ours. We have lived through in the last 30 years or so a really extraordinary period of widening standards of living, widening the levels of security in life and so on between different sectors of our society. But, of course, the thing the Gilded Age is most known for, and that it comes directly, I say, is reflected directly in the title of the famous book that Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner wrote about it, The Gilded Age, is corruption. Twain once said that the United States has no native criminal class with the exception of Congress. What he meant was that there was just so much malfeasance and chicanery and just downright bald, unapologetic corruption in the Congress that it was making a mockery out of the idea of democratic government. I don't think we have quite that level of corruption today amongst our public officials. And despite the occasional scandals that come to light, I think by and large our political class is a pretty responsible outfit. But the other element from that era that begs comparison with our own is the paralysis of government. A less well-known book written roughly the same time as The Gilded Age, but a very penetrating book in its own right, written in the 1880s by a man who would later become President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson. It was his doctoral dissertation at Johns Hopkins in the 1880s, and the book was published as Congressional Government, the title. And Wilson there argued that the country had an absolutely dysfunctional system of governance, not least of all because authority and accountability was so diffuse in the Congress that no one could take responsibility for what was done, and the public couldn't see with any degree of transparency how the legislative process worked. And there were all kinds of inside dealings and log rolling and so on, and the result was a government that was just very unresponsive to the real felt needs of the time. And that, I think, is the biggest legacy to us from the, or lesson to us, I should say, from the Gilded Age period, is just how ineffective government was for a full long generation, 30 years or more at the end of the 19th century, in the face of accumulating issues of really major proportions, like massive immigration and the rise of this country to potential world power status, the shift to an industrial economy, dealing with the reconstructed South, trying to make the West habitable through development projects of various kinds, all of which largely went unattended to or very badly attended to because government was so ineffective. That it seems to me, is the really fetching and compelling comparison between that time and ours. We know as a people that we have major issues on our docket and on our plate, and we just don't seem to be able to come to grips with them because government seems to be so paralyzed and ineffective. Yeah.
Certainly what struck me just with the little I have now read about the Gilded Age, and again in thinking about where the country was then and where we are now, is first of all that this period actually ended with a huge financial crash that until the Great Depression was the worst that the country had ever seen. But then also, and we could talk about that, but then also that it was followed by a great period of reform. It was followed by the Progressive Era. And so one wonders whether we could see some of these issues that are still longstanding issues addressed as a result of the pressure of, again, having come through this cycle of boom and bust.
Well, I hope it's not just whistling into the wind or whistling in the dark to think that, but I do think we can take some comfort and consolation from the reflection that this period of political stasis and ineffectiveness did yield to a period of extreme and really remarkable political innovation and political dynamism, social dynamism that we know is the Progressive Era. And we associate it with that period with two still very colorful and well-remembered presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, whereas I think most good students of American history would have trouble naming very many presidents in the period between Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt. There weren't many of any note. I think there's some grounds for hope there that eventually, as a people, we do come to our senses and recognize that these issues can't be deferred forever, and we generate political leaders of sufficient creativity and accomplishment to get something done.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is historian David Kennedy. He's professor of history emeritus at Stanford University. He's written a lot about American history. We're talking a little bit about the late 19th century in America, this time that we think about as the Gilded Age. And as I mentioned, we do that because of a novel that Mark Twain wrote. That's what he called it, the Gilded Age. And certainly it was a commentary on that time. But for years now, at least going back to the early 2000s, people were writing about America and saying that we were in another Gilded Age, that time is much like this. And we thought it'd be interesting to talk about the Gilded Age and say, well, are there appropriate comparisons there? 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, talk a little bit about the crash of 1893. What happened?
Well, as you rightly say, it was one of the most catastrophic economic downturns in all of American history. It's really matched or rivaled at a distance by the crash of the 1870s and then the 1930s, possibly the one of our own time, which is actually probably not nearly as bad. But the this extravagant period of economic growth and widening disparities in income and wealth, and great social stresses associated, as I said, with things like immigration, all came to a real boiling head in the 1890s when stock values collapsed, unemployment was massive, there were major labor riots in the 1890s and labor management confrontations, bloodshed, and so on. United States foreign trade virtually dried up to nothing. It was a very, very severely bad time, and that's historians think that that was the last gasp politically of the so-called Gilded Age. The Gilded Age, I might say, in addition, was also characterized by the inability of either party to really keep control of the system of governance for more than a few years at a time. The House changed hands, I think, half a dozen times over a 30-year period. There were virtually no years, very, very few, when both a single party controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency. That all changes in 1896 with the election of William McKinley. The Republican Party ascends to a very secure, ascendant, and dominant position in the American political system for about the next 3.5 decades, punctuated only by the presidency of Woodrow Wilson. So we get stability in the system after 1896. That's one of the results. And in a period of political stability, you actually get some political efficiency. You get the government that emerges that thinks of itself and is capable of acting commensurately with the scale of the issues that are out there in the society and the economy.
Yeah, I think it's certainly and if you look at what was happening after this point here, after the crash, and when we get into the progressive era, that so many sort of basic institutions of government, particularly when it comes to regulation, and maybe they're also the things that some conservatives would point to with scorn, but some very basic institutions, that is the time when they are born.
That's right. For example, we get things like the Pure Food and Drug Act in the Theodore Roosevelt administration. We get the Federal Reserve System in the Woodrow Wilson administration. We get strengthened antitrust laws. You get the beginnings, at least, of things like workmen's compensation laws. So, yeah, there's a real turning point, a real inflection point in the curve of American social, economic, political development that occurs in that period.
And I think also, is this not also the time when the income tax was instituted?
Income tax goes into place right on the eve of World War I, just in time to help finance American participation in that war. Although, actually, it turns out to be the income tax is a very modest proposition until World War II. As late as the eve of World War II, only about 4% of households paid any income tax whatsoever. So we live in an income tax era that's completely different from what existed before the Second World War. But it does have its origins, you're absolutely right, in 1914.
The Gilded Age, the time before the crash, one of the things that you can see then is that there was this booming economy, and you have the appearance and the growth of big corporations. So this is the time of the birth of companies, and some of them are still with us, like U.S. Steel and Standard Oil and AT&T and General Electric and a lot of others. And as a result, some people became very wealthy, and they were not shy about showing their wealth. And some people say, well, that today's big corporations and the people who lead them are like these people that we call the robber barons of the Gilded Age. Is that an appropriate comparison, do you think?
Well, I think so. But actually, there's another side to that story which often goes overlooked, and
mm-hmm.
I'll just touch on it briefly.
Sure.
You're absolutely correct. The first U.S. corporation that had a market capital value of over $1 billion was U.S. Steel when it incorporated for the first time in 1901. So in a sense, that billion-dollar market cap for U.S. Steel is the herald of this age of big, gigantic business enterprises to come. Now, one of the people who profited most from U.S. Steel, of course, is Andrew Carnegie. And Carnegie also wrote a very famous article in a magazine called the North American Review a few years earlier. The article was entitled simply Wealth, which I suppose is appropriate given who he was and the age and so on. But actually, that article to this day is a kind of a charter for American philanthropy. And in it, Carnegie argued, the man who dies rich dies disgraced. And his idea was that he and the fellow so-called robber barons of his age, not a term he used, were stewards of society's wealth and resources for the following generations, and they had to dispose of their wealth wisely. So he set up the Carnegie Corporation, built those Carnegie libraries all over this country and elsewhere. And he had a lot of company in that enterprise. People like Leland Stanford, who founded the university where I've taught for many years. John D. Rockefeller founded the University of Chicago at about the same time for similar reasons. And there is a parallel with that today, it seems to me, in these mega philanthropies of people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, and out here in California, David Packard and William Hewlett and Gordon Moore. These enormous foundations are characteristic of the American landscape in ways that we often maybe take for granted. The other countries don't have this tradition of philanthropy the way we do, and some of the much maligned robber barons of the last century and some of the much maligned super wealthy of our own time actually have this philanthropic impulse as well.
Mm. Well, I think that's an interesting point. I suppose what it says is that one should be a little careful about painting with the broad brush when you're talking about the individuals that we are, at least to acknowledge that it was maybe a little bit more complex than we often than the way that we often talk about them.
No, that's right.
Hmm. Something else that I found very interesting about this time also is that this was the time when people started to talk about social Darwinism. Which I know people will argue is a misapplication of the idea of natural selection, but what people thought they were doing, they were taking this idea of natural selection and applying it to societies, and that's when, I don't know that Darwin himself ever used a phrase like survival of the fittest, but that's when people started to talk that way, and apparently very influential here. There was a sociologist, his name was William Graham Sumner. Can you talk about him?
Yeah, William Graham Sumner was a professor at Yale, and he was the greatest American disciple and apostle of a British social theorist by the name of Herbert Spencer, who wrote a number of tracts about social theory in the mid-19th century. He actually wrote before Darwin published On the Origin of Species, but Darwinism laid out a biological theory that was then grafted onto this theory of social development that Spencer had preached and that William Graham Sumner took up. And, yeah, the essence of it is contained in that famous phrase, survival of the fittest. And the idea was that society will evolve in a positive direction just to the extent that it is not interfered with by government or other agencies, and the natural process of competition winnows out the weaker and empowers the stronger, and that's the way society as a whole will be made better. Now, that's a pretty crude social philosophy, if you state it that way. But if you really think it through, it was a philosophy that resonated deeply with a very, very deeply embedded characterological trait in the American DNA that goes back well before the 19th century, even. That we are a people who try to make the maximum space for personal liberty, and our personal striving will redound to the benefit of the community as a whole, just to the extent that it's not distorted by regulation, interference from government, and so on. It's not a philosophy I particularly like, to be honest. It's not my own personal belief, but it was a very strongly expressed belief in the 19th century, and vestiges of it are very much with us today.
Mm-hmm. Well, that it had some fairly powerful influence. Influenced the way that people thought about social policy, particularly when it came to the disadvantaged and whether or not, you know, who was responsible for their being disadvantaged, and was there then some obligation of government or people who had advantage to then try to help them.
That's absolutely right. I believe it was William Graham Sumner who was once asked by his contemporary social reformer, Henry George, what can be done about the great social and economic problems of our day? And Sumner replied, nothing, absolutely nothing. And maybe in 5,000 years things will have rectified themselves, but we can do nothing, and if we try to do anything, we'll just make more mischief. So there's the idea that society is its own integral, organic thing, and to mess around with it is probably to do more harm than good.
Mm. So were the progressives really influenced by or reacting against that kind of thinking and perhaps some of the other factors we've talked about before? Is the progressive area really in reaction to the Gilded Age?
Yeah, very much so. And you could even tell the story just the way you've been setting it up as a reaction to the social Darwinist philosophy. There was at the time a very famous book written by, at the time, was probably the most famous journalist in America, Walter Lippmann, in 1914, I believe, called Drift and Mastery. And the whole thesis of that book, which became a kind of a Bible for the progressive movement, was that we were living in a time of drift and just letting things go willy-nilly where they might and not always ending up well. But we had it in our capacity, thanks to the instruments of representative democratic government, a government ultimately responsible to the people, not just some third-party agency. We had it in our power to impose some kind of mastery on this situation, to control it, to direct the process of social development, to achieve certain outcomes, and that was a legitimate thing to do. And the argument over the legitimacy of that is of that kind of social intervention on the part of government is the core innovation, you might say, of the progressive movement, is that it, the progressive era, began to establish the legitimacy of that kind of thinking. It's still contested in our society even today, whether it's an appropriate thing to do or not. But all the vocabulary and the grammar and the syntax with which we discuss that matter today really come down to us from the progressive era of 100 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's really striking that we are still having that argument.
Mm. And we're having it much more vigorously than peoples in the societies that we usually compare ourselves with, especially in the Western world, the North Atlantic community, Western Europe. They've had these arguments, too, over time. They've taken different forms in different societies. But they've kind of settled the matter to an extent that we never seem to have done. So we're much more contentious and disputatious about this than a lot of our sister societies.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is David Kennedy. He's a professor of history emeritus at Stanford University. He has written a lot about American history. He won the Pulitzer Prize for history for his book Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 through 1945. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for a book that he wrote about World War I. That book, World War I Over Here, the First World War in American Society. He is joining us this morning to talk about, we're talking particularly about this time in American history, well, the time where we are now, but also the time in the late 19th century that is referred to as the Gilded Age. We grabbed that off of the title of a novel by Mark Twain, who wrote at the time. And for the past now several years, at least going back to the early 2000s, people were writing about the America of that time and the American economy and saying, well, that it's much like the Gilded Age. And as we have pointed out, the Gilded Age ended where there was a major economic crash, and perhaps that would lead people further down that line and say, yes, indeed, there is something about our time that's like that time. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about that, and Professor Kennedy was good enough to say yes, he would give us some of his time. And questions, comments, people want to be involved in the conversation, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. And you may also send along your comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Was there much labor activism in the United States before 1900?
Well, yes, there was, but it was pretty ramshackle and disorganized and not terribly effective. Partly, historians think, again, if you contrast the experience of this country, the history of labor, particularly organized labor in this country, with other countries that were also experiencing the Industrial Revolution as we were, it's quite a different picture. I mean, most of the European countries, you get the formation of labor parties or even socialist or even communist parties that are based on working class membership and working class interests. We never get that kind of thing here. Right down to the present day, we've never had a party that really looks like the British Labor Party or the French Socialist Party or the Italian Communist Party or what have you. And part of the reason for that, we think, is that unlike all those other countries, our working class was to a remarkable degree composed of people from different ethnic and cultural and national and linguistic backgrounds, thanks to immigration. And they were people who literally, in many cases, could not talk to one another. They had no language in common. They had some common interests as members of the working class, but they didn't have that kind of cultural cohesion through language and shared religion and background and so on that would have allowed them to form a working-class political party. So it's just one of the structural features of the American working class that gave us the particular kind of history we've had. But that all said, there were plenty of labor confrontations, some of them quite disruptive and even violent in the 1870s, again in the context of the economic crisis of that decade, and then again in the 1890s, including very famous confrontations at Pullman, where workers went on strike and essentially stopped railroad traffic all over the country, and the federal government intervened with troops, and people died. There was another one at Homestead, Pennsylvania, at roughly the same time, in the steel mills of that area, where Pinkerton private troops and detectives were brought in, and more bloodshed. So these were major eruptions of a kind that we really haven't seen in this country for the last several generations, but that were, if not exactly normal, certainly much more frequent at that time than our own.
Yeah, this was the time of the Haymarket riot. I think there are a lot of people who question calling it that, but maybe one of the more famous events in the history of labor conflict in this country.
Yes, absolutely. It was a labor rally where somebody threw a bomb and people were killed, and there were all these very aggressive prosecutions of people later, and Illinois Governor John Altgeld later tried to pardon some of the people who were convicted, and that blighted his political career. So, these events reverberated for years thereafter, became kind of totems and landmarks and symbols of the cause of labor in the United States. And that kind of violence really didn't go away until the 1930s.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Someone in Champaign County here where we are. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Yes. Hello?
Yes. Yes, go ahead. Hello? Yes.
Okay. I kind of got confused in your remarks there. The amount of violence, that's a good explanation for why there was never a labor party, it seems to me. There was a lot of collusion amongst company unions and that sort of stuff. The undermining of the labor movement is probably why there wasn't a labor party to a large extent, it seems to me. That's a more straightforward explanation. I don't know how much you allow to that. I was actually motivated to call because of your remarks about how Robert Barons can be philanthropists. Well, that's obviously a caricature of what you said, but the idea is there. What about a robber serf, somebody who steals bread and then shares it with somebody else? That's philanthropy at a lower scale, and people are sympathetic to that too. But when you're ripping people off in the labor market, and then you turn around and endow a library, that's how does one, I don't know. It doesn't really take away the guilt of the robber barons as much as I thought I heard you say, in your opinion. And I think we really are in a very gilded age. I just heard a statistic that the corporate bonuses this year amount to 1% of GDP. Astonishing, after all of the bailouts. And could you react to a couple of those premises?
I can't comment on the 1% of GDP bonuses. I just don't know what the lay of the land is there. But you make a very good point that among the other things, the other factors that go into the explanation of why we didn't have a more robust labor movement in this country 100 and 150 years ago is precisely what you said, that it was often violently suppressed. And that runs right through to the violent suppression of the strikes in the automobile regions in the 1930s by the Ford Motor Company's own private police force.
I was actually making the point that the political expression of the labor movement was also very damaged by the same kind of repression.
So well, that's absolutely right, and it proved then, as people used a word then that still gets circulated today, they accused the labor movement of being socialist, and for a lot of middle-class Americans, that was enough to really taint it. But and then I wanted to speak to your second point, if I might, about the robber barons and whether they should be exculpated or not because of their philanthropy. It's a big question about Andrew Carnegie in particular, one that his biographers and historians still debate to this day, to what extent his philanthropy was really driven by the guilt he felt about the violence inflicted on workers at the Homestead strike in the 1890s. There's some evidence to suggest that that's what really awakened his conscience and turned him in that direction. So there is a link between these kinds of developments, yes.
In a contemporary situation, we have philanthropy, and we've had this people like Bill Gates' father campaigning against the so-called death tax, and now we have this pledge of a bunch of billionaires to give away half of their wealth or something like that. I forget the actual statistics on that. But a lot of that giving away is also, if not guilt-driven, some of it is kind of directed to remaking the political system. I'm thinking of Gates and his funding of education projects. Now, I see it as undermining public education, concentration on charter schools, and it's actually charter schools are a business opportunity for a bunch of wealthy folks. It's astonishing how there isn't more discourse about how much money is being made, and not just by the leaders of these charter movements like Canada himself in Manhattan, but the people that are doing these bizarre investment, I think they're scams in educational systems. And it seems that there's a political agenda behind what looks like beneficence. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, anything else that you want to...
Well,
way you want to follow
I
up?
I think I might respectfully disagree that the initiatives of the Gates Foundation and others to find some kind of a pathway forward for our public educational system are really meant to subvert the whole thing and create profit opportunities for other mega millionaires in the future. I think that's really a pretty gross caricature of what they're up to. I think many people in this country are groping for some means by which to improve an educational system that is clearly dysfunctional and in trouble. Charter schools is one answer to that. But I share the caller's concern that our historically inherited system of public education, which has served us well for many, many, many generations, is at risk. And it could be that some of these innovations in the private or semi-private sector, like charter schools, for all the benefits that they confer, unless those innovations are brought back into the public system in a big way, I think we are in danger of subverting this historical system. We also shouldn't get too exercised about the scale of interventions. As I heard a talk by Bill Gates here a year or two ago, which he said that the entire balance sheet, the entire net worth of his foundation, just $30-some billion, is less than the annual expenditures of the California State Department of Education. So the public educational sector remains mighty big.
Well, let's go to another caller here. Urbana and line two. Hello. Is there a caller there, line two, Urbana? How about we'll go to Robinson then, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm speaking as an amateur historian only, and this may be too simplified for some people, but a lot of your listeners may not be aware of the difference between the Golden Age and the Gilded Age. That the Golden Age is a time of looking backwards to a time when things were idyllic, much as the Supreme Court today tries to look back to the Revolution as the end-all and be-all of any legislation, versus the Gilded Age, where a very thin coating of gold is sprayed upon or baked upon a base metal of people who sprang from nothing and tried to appear better than they ever were. Are there any comments upon that?
Well, I think we, many of us, maybe all of us, have some notion in our minds that there was a period in the past and when things were rosier or more golden than they are now. I mean, that is, in a sense, kind of built into our cultural DNA for the whole myth of, or the whole, I shouldn't say myth, but the whole idea of Eden and the fall from paradise. This has been part of our tradition for thousands of years to think that way. And yes, I mean, the relationship, just rhetorically, between golden and gilded is suggestive that the Gilded Age is a fake golden age, and we shouldn't be seduced by it. I think that's a very good point.
One other comment I might make is what Mark Twain had in mind is that after the centennial celebration of 1876, people began to take down from their attics their spinning wheels and their relics of the Revolution, and spinning wheels were put into the parlor, but they were first sprayed with bronze paint to gild them. Thank you for considering this.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, I don't know about that, but I think that the caller captures fairly well the spirit in which Twain and his co-author produced this book in the early 1890s. I think that, as he said, that's exactly what it is that Twain had in mind.
Well, we shouldn't forget that Mark Twain was also, as the recent publication of his autobiography has reminded us, he was an increasingly bitter, misanthropic character. Mm. So I think we should take his characterization of this age with at least a little bit of a pinch of salt, and not take it literally. Not to contradict him, but just to remind ourselves that, as you said earlier, David, we shouldn't paint with too broad a brush. Mm. We have to be attentive to some nuance and detail.
All right. He did not intend it as a work of journalism, but as a work of social satire,
exactly.
From his reflecting that, as you say, reflecting his characteristic point of view.
That's right.
To another caller, this is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought I was on two. Anyway, I was just calling. I'm not sure what the program is about because I just came in the middle and you were talking about the riots and things like that and the unions. And I was just wondering what the author, or you as the case may be, thinks. I mean, are we going to get to that point again where it's bad enough that people are going to riot on large scales? Hello?
Well, yes. Professor Kennedy, you have some thought about that?
Well, it's always dangerous to predict the future. It's... We don't have any data from the future, so, and historians, what they know about is the past, not the future. So I'm always reluctant to make predictions like that, whether we'll see rioting. I will say that as the Great Depression of the 1930s settled in 1929, 1930, 31, 32, many people, including Franklin Roosevelt on the campaign trail in 1932 when he was running for president, but he was not alone. Many people remarked how curious it was that there was not more public protest, that people weren't taking to the streets and demanding some kind of political counterpunch to this great economic crisis that was coming over the horizon. And that there's something in there to be explained about why we get some violence later in the 1930s, in the Depression era, especially again in the automobile districts in 1936 and 37, and the general strike in San Francisco in 1934. But it's remarkable to me and to other observers how relatively passive the American people were in the face of this crisis in the very early 1930s. And the best explanation that I've heard for that is one that goes back to the greatest analyst of American society ever, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his great book, Democracy in America, where he coined a word to describe something he thought was unique and new in the world, and it was a psychological trait he saw in American society. The word is now common, but he coined it. It's individualism. And the idea was that he thought it was just absolutely remarkable how people in the United States, unlike people elsewhere, had this very amplified idea of their own capacity and their own ability to make their way in the world, and really did not, and they congratulated themselves, gave themselves a big pat on the back whenever they succeeded. They were captains of their own destiny, masters of their own fate. And that very attitude, productive and energy-making as it has been in our society, has also been an obstacle to collective action, to people joining hands and realizing they're all in the same boat and so on. So, again, it's just a long-term characteristic of our society that we've nurtured that kind of psychological outlook, and that has implications for the occasional ineffectiveness of our collective political system.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's just the inequity of the top 1% having 80% of the wealth, and I guess the you mentioned it earlier, the stigma of socialism. You know, you can't have a social movement, or you're going down the wrong path, and we're going to all become communist or whatever. Boggles my mind that there hasn't been some sort of movement about it.
Well, here's another contemporary example in our own time that is hard to explain unless you make reference to these kinds of psychological notions about individualism and so on. And it is the great unpopularity out there amongst majorities of the American public to a higher estate tax rate. This is being debated in Congress this very week. The number of people or households that are affected by the estate tax is absolutely minuscule. But people don't want to change it or lower the threshold where estates become taxable, presumably because they all think that someday I'm going to get there. And when I get there, I don't want to have to face this big tax bill. That is highly unrealistic. That's not the way the world works. And virtually all the people that have that expectation will be disappointed. But it's still part of our cultural attitude that we think that we can do that, and therefore we want the system to be in our favor when that happens.
Yeah, our guest in this hour, I think I should introduce again. Our guest is David Kennedy. He's professor of history emeritus at Stanford University. Has written a lot about American history, and was good enough to spend some time here talking with us about the notion that you read often, and now for a number of years, journalists, political commentators, a lot of people have been saying that the time where we were, particularly, say, before 2008, that there were great parallels between that time and this time that is known as the Gilded Age. The title, the name comes from a novel that Mark Twain wrote. We're talking about the late 1800s, a time when there was a big economic boom in the country, the beginnings of some major corporations. Some people got very wealthy, and it was a time when there was a great spread in between the people who were at the top and the people who were at the bottom, which was then followed in the early 1890s by a major financial crash, the worst until the Depression came along, which was then followed by a great period of reform. And we thought it'd just be interesting to talk a little bit about that time and this time and ask the question, well, is it really, are there real parallels between the times we're living through now and that time? Just maybe one other thing in terms of parallel I might ask you to talk at least about for a minute or two. It seems also that this time we're talking about around the years around 1900, also in the America, this was the golden age, speaking of golden ages, this was the golden age of populism.
Yes.
Which was at that time very much a rural-based movement.
Yes.
But I wonder whether also some people would try to argue that that the Tea Party movement is a kind of contemporary populist movement, and there is some sort of connection between that sort of sentiment, but between the kind of sentiment and the ideas voiced by people in both movements.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think both the populist movement of the 1890s in particular and the Tea Party have their origins in some very deep resentments against something or somebody. But there is a crucial difference, it seems to me, that the populist movement of the late 19th century, it looked to government for solutions. Its enemies, as it were the big corporations, the railroads, the big food processors, and the banks, and so on. And the populists thought that the proper remedy to the power of those kinds of outfits was to strengthen government and put government to work for the people. Today's Tea Party, at least as I understand it, its enemy is government. I mean, it's kind of adopted the the Ronald Reagan mantra that government is not the solution, government is the problem. So it arises out of some similar psychological ground, but is directed to very, very different political objectives than was the movement of the late 19th century.
Yeah. Well, given though that they're also their unhappiness with Wall Street, one wonders, well, where do they think the solution actually lies? If not with either the private sector or with government, then where?
Well, exactly. And it seems to me, and it seemed to a lot of people, the populist and progressive eras especially, the obvious answer is that it's government. We have to make government capable of dealing with and, when necessary, counterpunching to the power of these enormous entities that have emerged in the private sector and finance and manufacturing, transportation, and so on. That was the populist agenda, and to a significant degree was also the progressive agenda and the New Deal agenda. But we seem to have turned that around. We think that much as we might resent the power of those institutions, we're unwilling, at least some people in the Tea Party at least, seem to be unwilling to embrace the obvious solution.
We have two other callers. We'll try to get them both. First in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. On the question of the Labor Party, this is Jim in Urbana, Public Television, Labor's World View. We think that the reason we don't have a Labor Party today is because of sabotage by the Democratic Party from the 19th century through the 20th, and even now into the 21st. Look at the 1916 election of Eugene Victor Debs. He was thrown into prison by the great liberal Democrat Woodrow Wilson for no other reason than opposing the imposition of the military draft in the First World War. He got over 1 million write-in votes, prisoner 861, in that year. I mean, the workers were for it. We've always been for a Labor Party. It's always been sabotaged by, A, the capitalist class and class collaborationist politics, by the AFL-CIO bureaucracy, et cetera, et cetera. And if you'd like to comment on that, I'd love to hear it. Thank you.
You remind me of a famous exchange between Franklin Roosevelt and Norman Thomas, who was then the head of the American Socialist Party in the 1930s. Actually, it's not an exchange between the two of them. It was a question that a reporter asked Norman Thomas. He said, hasn't the New Deal carried out the program of the American Socialist Party? And Norman Thomas says, yes, it has, on a stretcher, which I think captures your point, that the mainstream political system, some would allege, has done just enough to bleed off the discontent of workers, especially, so as to impede the development of a really vigorous working-class political movement. So I think there's something to that, yeah.
All right, one more caller here. It's on a cell phone in Champaign in line three. Hello? Yes, hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
As usual, I always enjoy the exchange. Just a question, comment for the speakers. Very good discussion. If I'm not mistaken, one of the reasons for the lack of public protest in the 1920s, and the other call, the other discussion was spot on. This was not just the 1930s, 20s rather. This went back to 1890. There were many, many, many strikes by railroad, by miners, especially. The labor industry was led by the mining industry. But the bottom line is the police, the military, and the so-called, you've heard of the expression railroad, they were coal and iron police stretching from the Pennsylvania all the way through Colorado into California. They brutally suppressed any potential strike. The police were there to suppress, not to support. That's clearly documented. People, the farmers, if they were driven off their lands, and then the banks would hire bulldozers, and they would come through and tear the house down right in front of the former occupant. And if the occupant threatened the driver of that machine, he would be hauled off by the police. So there was no public outcry to say, because they would be shot or imprisoned. There was no toleration for any public.
I got to jump in here as we're getting short on time. I don't know, Professor Kennedy, again, you want to comment on that?
Well, I think these stories about labor violence and so on are very colorful, and they are numerous. I don't dispute that a bit, but I think that it's easy to exaggerate them. But there is a very significant point in what the caller says, and that is that the leaders of the organized labor movement, particularly Samuel Gompers at the American Federation of Labor, among the reasons why they were wary of social legislation like the Social Security Act, which they long opposed, is precisely because there was this long history of government collusion with capital and with management, and a lot of the labor leaders did not think government was a reliable partner in the arena of social improvement and trying to improve labor's lot. So that there is that history that the caller calls our attention to, and that's absolutely right, and it had real consequences.
Just now, we have about 30 seconds or a minute. We wouldn't have done this if we didn't think it would lead to an interesting conversation, but I also wonder, as an historian, whether you think this kind of exercise is actually has a point to it. That is, these things where we say, well, is time A like time B, or are we now continuing to live with the same sorts of challenges and respond in the same ways that people did 100 years ago or 150 years ago?
Well, I think it's necessary to make these kinds of comparisons, not so that we can reassure ourselves that we're just recapitulating some other generation's history, but so that we can identify what is new in our situation and unlike theirs, and where we have to be more clever than just relying on precedent and old thinking. So I think the only way we can really understand what's new in the world is to understand what's old. And that means to study history, to know the uniqueness, for better or worse, of our own situation. So I think these kinds of exercises are not just interesting, but absolutely necessary.
All right. Our guest, David Kennedy, is the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University. Professor Kennedy, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, David. That's been a pleasure.